You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education podcast. I'm Sarah Custer, the Associate Editor for Curation here at THE.
And I am Miranda Prynne, Content Curator for THE Campus, a new project launched by Times Higher.
Yeah, so we wanted to speak with you quickly about THE Campus. It is a new global teaching and learning community that THE has launched on the back of the massive transition to online higher education that we've seen throughout 2020 and continuing on to 2021, which I'm sure you're all very aware of. What we're trying to do on THE Campus is provide a platform for that expertise around teaching and learning, online teaching and learning in higher education, to really be showcased. That could be knowledge that has existed from experts who have specialized in this for a number of years, but also the people who have become experts along the way, either off their own back or with the help of their institution. And it's really a place to share that knowledge and ultimately deliver the best digital higher education for their students. Part of that is this podcast. So we'll have a fortnightly spotlight series where we will be addressing specific topics around online teaching and learning and bringing you people who can speak about those topics in special and interesting ways.
Our most recent spotlight came out on February 11th.
Miranda, what are we looking at on that one?
Well, we're looking at kind of issues around resiliency and well-being, and this applies to kind of university staff as well as students, because one of the things that has become really clear in the many conversations we've been having with faculty and university leaders, and also Times Higher's own research, has shown that while kind of massive progress has been made and huge achievements made in this kind of online learning space and the transition to it, it's come at a huge human cost in terms of workload and many other aspects, which we will sort of come on to discuss.
Yeah, and we've got quite a few academics, university teaching staff from around the world who have contributed pieces to our first kind of content package around resiliency, avoiding burnout, well-being. What can people look forward to seeing in that first spotlight package?
Yeah, we've got a really good range, actually, because we've got quite a lot of resources that are on sort of more practical issues of what the universities, the institutions should and can be doing to support their staff. So as you've alluded to, a lot of university staff really hadn't had much experience of online learning prior to 2020. And it's been a very steep learning curve for the last 12 months. So what resources, training, kind of practical help can universities offer, but also what help can they offer on the kind of more well-being side and you know, changes to the sort of approach to leadership, that sort of thing. But then we also have spoken to a number of academics who've just provided slightly more kind of personal and human advice, I suppose, around the well-being aspect and what individual academics can be doing to sort of protect themselves a bit, build their resiliency, but also just be aware of their own limits and boundaries and how far they can push themselves so that, you know, they don't end up risking real burnout.
And also about maintaining those relationships with their colleagues as well as their students, I imagine was a huge challenge for everyone who's been forced to work from home now, but I imagine is especially crucial to the work that academics are doing and in their teaching.
That's come across really clearly, actually, that sort of need for human connection. So creating kind of support networks around yourself, hopefully facilitated by the universities, if it is between sort of staff. Also creating connection with students as far as is possible. You know, you can create really strong relationships via digital channels if you know how to use them and leverage them successfully. So I think fighting that feeling of isolation and the feeling that you're kind of on your own working just in a silo is really helpful, or clearly what we've been told is that is a hugely helpful way to combat feelings of anxiety and other problems.
So All of those resources are on THE Campus, and that is at timeshighereducation.com/campus. That's where you can see our first spotlight of the new platform. That's timeshighereducation.com/campus. And you will see our resiliency package there for you to go and explore. And we hope you find it helpful. But today, we're bringing you some interviews with people who have a quite unique perspective on this situation. First up is my interview with Thuy Thai Nguyen, who is the president of Foothill College in Los Altos, California. Now, Foothill College is a community college in the U.S., actually. But I started out with talking to Thuy about compassionate leadership and how she's really incorporated this into her role leading the community college. And she said that compassionate leadership is especially important for community college world because it is that community aspect that requires this compassionate component. Miranda, who did you have a chat with?
Yeah, I spoke to June Gruber, who is an associate professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of Colorado. And it's interesting because Thuy obviously represents sort of university leadership, June very much a sort of faculty perspective, but also definitely agreed on the importance of that sort of compassionate leadership element. June was very focused around sort of this idea of kindness more generally, being kind to your peers, kind to yourself, and you know, using that as a tool really to help us all get through a difficult period.
Great. Well, let's go to Thuy's interview first, and I started out with asking her just how she would define compassionate leadership. Thuy, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm speaking to you on the very last days of the fall term of 2020, which is the end of a very difficult and trying and sad year for all of us, especially the university community. And I'm wondering if we could just start off by talking about what compassionate leadership means to you and how you would perhaps define that for someone who had never heard that term before.
Well, good morning. You know, I'm as president of Foothill College. It's a college with about 15,000 students plus about 700 employees plus. And, you know, to be in an environment where you are caring, caretaking, not only the facility institution, but the people in it. It's really important to come at it from a compassionate, caring level. And in fact, I often find myself teaching compassionate leadership to our management team, what I call the triangle of love, truth, and power. And so compassionate leadership to me is how do we demonstrate our love for our students and our love for each other and our love for our mission and be motivated by all angles. And so compassionate leadership for me means being able to be in other people's shoes, to understand their needs and concerns, and also to be able to demonstrate it and demonstrate it in a way that they need it, not how we see, we the individual see how we are compassionate and loving, but that we demonstrate it in a way that is compassionate and loving to the people who are receiving it. And so compassionate leadership is really, really important. Especially in the community college world, the word community is that component of compassion, that finding each other's humanity.
Having known you for a little bit now, you were on a panel of mine for THE's Leadership and Management Summit earlier this year. Having known you, you strike me as a person who was already practicing compassionate leadership before this pandemic began. But is there any way that your approach has perhaps changed as a result of the pandemic, your approach, your compassionate leadership approach?
Absolutely. The World Health Organization defines health as the physical, social, and mental well-being of a person, not just the absence of disease or infirmity. And so as the world is trying to come together really put a stop to COVID-19, there is an effect of it too. That effect, both from the disease itself to the economic fallout, is the effect on the mental health and social well-being of a person. And so part of the work of compassionate leadership is to be mindful of all that element and see the human, the person, the student, the faculty, staff, to see them as a whole person. And so, As we practice, as we try to practice at our college to be a loving college, there is no doubt that during this pandemic, we had to also really call that out to be able to take care of each other. Two things that I have been doing. One is why we need to have shelter in place, why we need to mask up. I do it within the context of not that this is required of us, that you know, we don't have any other choice, but I do it in the context of this is what it means to be a member of the community, to mask up for your own protection, but also for the protection of the community. And so even as I talk about my decisions around the pandemic, I always talk about it within our role as a college, as an institution, our social role to the community, to our region. And so having that kind of language is really important in demonstrating that we come to the work very much with a value set of community. And part and parcel of that is compassion, loving, caring, and the like. So that's one. It's just how I talk about the pandemic. The second is in terms of how I approach the crisis management at the college itself. And so, you know, I really make a point to constantly think about what do I think people need? What do I think people need? And not just in terms of the widgets of the technology, the professional development, the how-tos, et cetera, but also what could people be feeling? How, you know, their family dynamics, their work and home environment, the stressors of being parent and caretakers of their parents, and so many of those elements. So really being in that mode and then therefore thinking about how to manage the crisis within that context. And so as a result, we even at one point had a whole conversation during one of my president's briefing, along with other briefings, but one that was really dedicated to that conversation of the word compassion itself. And we talked about not only that what it will take is compassion, that it, we are requesting from each other compassion, but what does compassion even look like? What does compassion mean for a student? It's more than saying, I really care for you, you know, reach out, et cetera. Of course, that's important too. But also when a student is asking for compassion in this light, what do they mean? Do they mean a certain type of email, a certain way of emailing, a certain way of responding? So we actually had a whole conversation of what compassion looks like and means to each other, so that we could even be better at demonstrating our compassion.
This podcast episode will be airing at the time that we're speaking about resiliency on campus, on THE campus. I'm wondering if you see any sort of connection between compassionate leadership and the ability for your university staff, your faculty, the students on your campus to be more resilient as a result.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's so critical, not only because it's the right thing to do in terms of being compassionate, being loving, being caring, but it's also really important that people know it. And when they know it, they know that you're trying your best. And so there is an element of forgiveness that comes very easily, more readily. In that. And so people don't, I've never found people to give me or my administrative team or each other a hard time for why didn't you do this or why didn't you do that with regards to handling the pandemic. And so that I think is in many ways, even though it's the right thing to do, it is also a very smart strategy because people are much more forgiving. Giving each other the benefit of the doubt in the work. And then the other is also when people know that they are loved, that they are that someone is thinking about them and is thinking for them, then, you know, your sense of I'm not alone. And it's a word that I often say to our students and communicate to our students. You're not alone. We're in this together. And so for all those reasons, people's ability to plow forward is more likely. And that sense of resiliency is more likely.
Hmm. We're, as I mentioned earlier, we're speaking at the end of a very difficult and a sad year. And even though you are speaking very eloquently and beautifully about compassionate leadership and community and all belonging together, I'm wondering if there has ever been a point this year whenever you yourself have felt overwhelmed and energies completely depleted, and how you coped with that and continued to press ahead to lead Foothill College.
Yes. One is I have to always remember I need to practice what I preach. And so as much as I tell the college around self-care, I often, almost at every briefing, I remind them about our employee assistance program, really going into a little bit of some detail around what the program entails so that employees can always pick up the phone to call if they just want, some counseling on any aspect that the program provides. As much as I tell people, take care of each other, be good to yourself, you're not alone, I also have to remind myself that I can only help my college if I myself have the feel necessary. And it's something that I often teach to our management team around this concept of red energy and black energy. Red energy, just like accounting, you're in the red, it's not good. Black energy is you're good. You're like in accounting, you have the funds to expend. Mm-hmm. And so, and one of the things I often tell our management team is you cannot be in the red and help your team that is in the red. You have to be in the black first to be able to help your team get out of the red into the black. And so it's also something that I have to remind myself to in terms of my own health, both physical health, mental health, my surrounding, my environment, my calm, so that I could also help my college and navigate through this. So one is just constantly having to remind myself, you need to take care of yourself too, Twee. Right. But the other, and so then as a result, I've started implementing some things for myself. For instance, unfortunately, I haven't had a vacation since the pandemic. And so I really haven't been able to refuel for an extended period of time. So as a result, I promised myself that I really would give myself a weekend and at least refuel in that way. And so far, I would not give myself an A on this. But with that said, some things that I've done is I actually closed down my workspace, which, as you know, is at home. And so close everything so there is no sign of work at my home. And so being able to just even mentally close down and then physically my environment to close down. Then, of course, I love, one of the silver linings of this pandemic is normally I'm never able to get home to have family dinners. But now being able to just have a family dinner with my children who are school age kids has been great. We're starting to walk. I entered a turkey trot fundraiser for Thanksgiving. So it forced the whole family to go out and walk, and we've discovered we like this. So we've been keeping it up. I love Korean drama, as some people may know from my Twitter account. So I just have a lot of fun on Twitter talking about Korean drama, talking about other things that are not so work-related, but, not too overboard either, connecting with a Twitter community. As I teasingly said, Twitter is my form of anti-social distancing. So... just doing things like that to really kind of get ready for the week.
To take it back to a bit more of a serious matter now, but I don't think you mind. the vice chancellor of the University of Leeds, Simone Buitendijk, has also spoken quite a bit about compassionate leadership, and she's written a blog recently. And it says in that blog, she says that compassionate leadership actually has the capacity to change the world, with universities at the forefront of that change. And that's something that I think a lot of university presidents rightly talk about, is just the capacity of their institutions to change the world, via X channel, but it's often not talked about in the context of compassionate leadership. I'm wondering how that resonates with you, and any sort of ideas you could have to make sure that compassionate leadership does change the world after this pandemic is over, hopefully soon.
Absolutely. I mean, in addition to everything that I've said, the word actually compassion has always been a critical word and concept in describing various things. And so I've taken that word very much to hold, more so because students were expressing that word and during this pandemic. But before, the word that I often use is love, and being able to be loving and show love and kindness toward each other. So and that kindness is critical in the dynamic of when one is being truthful around, you know, some areas that need to be improved, but do it in a loving way. It has an important affect and effect on people. So the notion of lovingness is really important. And at my opening day, as we were talking about the racial reckoning that's happening in the United States, and in particular our college, and we've been in this space for some time, even before the pandemic, but it's definitely accelerated the work. And how I ended it was a Vietnamese saying, Mawai thương lấy bí cùng, tuy rằng khác giống nhưng chung một dàn, which means, oh squash, please remember to love the melon. Even though you are from different seeds, you share the same vine. You share the same vine. And it's really this whole notion of finding our humanity, and it's finding our humanity that it will get us through the pandemic, but also finding our humanity that will get us to real solutions, transformative ones in the racial equity work. So it's always being able to do that. Whenever I'm on Zoom, I always press the reaction button of the heart. When I say goodbye to people, you'll see me do like the Korean version with the hand gesture of the heart, or the, you know, with the finger, the heart, and just really, and even my signing off on the last briefing this week for the year 2020, I always say I love you, you know, to our college. So that is really, really important in really demonstrating not only that you care, but also modeling it so that we demonstrate our care for each other. And quite frankly, when you have that, you and you're fueled by that love, you can then also be able to express that love to others, including your student.
I'm wondering how you think this sits within a higher education context, which I completely agree and applaud you for everything that you've just said about, especially the racial reckoning and the role that universities have in that, especially in the U.S.
Yeah.
Turning inward, though, and looking at the academic world, I feel would be a bit more challenging, especially considering the dynamics of competition and merit that the academic world has been built on. Right. How do you see compassion changing that, if at all?
Yeah, it changes the lens. I think it's really important. So say, for instance, during when I spoke with the group of our tenure track faculty who are going through tenure review, I make it very clear. My goal is the tenure review process is not a weeding out process. It's a bringing in and providing collegial peer feedback and trying to see if you are willing to grow as a faculty member. That demonstration of your mindset of the willingness to grow is so important to me, more so than weeding out. So that kind of language is really critical. And you can only imagine a faculty member right after emailed me and just said, thank you so much for saying that. You know, we don't need to be the way the competitiveness of academia, and so that's just one of many examples of really compassion, kindness, loving As I mentioned before, may sound like something that will get you a lot of brownie points when you're no longer on this earth. But it really is a strategy. It is a strategy that actually helps a college be comfortable, feel that they can change without feeling that they are being, unloved for it, like there was something deficient about them, but that they are in a good space to make changes and be transformative and always think about growing and not receding. So it's actually a really important strategy in organizational development. And in academia, it's even more so because, especially for too many colleges, when our students are constantly in need of that real sense of you can do this. We believe in you. But if you don't, if employees don't believe in each other, how can you be in a good space to say that to students? And they know it, right? We need to welcome students into a compassionate, kind, loving environment so they can grow.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your comments, Tui. I think that hopefully that will really resonate with some people and hopefully serve as an inspiration to anyone who serves any sort of leadership role in their own organization to consider how they could start incorporating a bit more compassion into their strategy. So thank you very much for that. I appreciate your time.
My final interview, like I said, every final thing I'm doing in 2020. So this is the final press interview. Bye.
Bye, Tui. Thank you. And that was Tui Tai Nguyen, the president of Foothill College in Los Altos, California. I really liked her final point about how being compassionate is really a strategy, an organizational strategy, and how she was saying that that really helps community colleges especially feel that they can change without feeling that they're deficient in something. And I think that applies to all universities and how it really allows them to grow, which is definitely a message that is something that I think all of us need to hear right now.
Yeah, definitely. And it, actually, I mean, a lot of what Tui has said ties in really nicely with my conversation with Jean and sort of, you know, changes and modes of both leadership and teaching that are kind of helpful at this time. So yeah, I've already mentioned kindness, but also, you know, flexibility and not necessarily expecting of yourself, but also, you know, others, the same level of performance or output that you might expect in, you know, normal in inverted commas times. So yeah, June can offer some really interesting sort of faculty perspective on that. So I am here with June Gruber, who is an associate professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of Colorado and director of the Positive Emotion and Psychopathology Laboratory, which means June is very well placed to talk about the issues we'll be coming on to, because we are chatting at the start of the new year, just as universities around the world are kind of preparing to return for the spring or indeed autumn semester, depending on where you are. And certainly here in the UK and across much of the world, we are back in a strict lockdown, COVID cases on the rise. So despite the vaccines being rolled out, there is certainly little immediate sign of a full return to campus. And universities, academics and students are facing kind of ongoing upheaval to their working practices. One of the major issues which has been raised repeatedly in the last few months is the toll that this is taking on many academics, with increased workloads, constant change between online, blended and in-person teaching, isolation, childcare issues and all sorts of other kind of problems and challenges thrown up by the pandemic. And of course, the students themselves are also really struggling. So it's kind of double whammy. So on that, the first thing I wanted to talk about, June, is just how you feel, I guess, academics on an individual level and indeed institutions can best manage these pressures for sort of staff and students. What can be done on a sort of practical day-to-day or potential longer term level?
Thank you. I think you're raising an extremely important question. And as you said, we are seeing an unprecedented global mental health crisis right now during this pandemic that is uniquely impacting higher education as well. So it's no surprise that we ought to be focusing on supporting and protecting our mental health as much as we're dedicating and devoting efforts to protecting our physical health. In terms of what can people do, I'm a clinical psychologist, and we think a lot about these questions, and I think the pandemic has really been a catalyst for putting mental health at the forefront in academia in a way that I think often it had been put to the side or even neglected, I would argue, in the past. In thinking about particular tips for supporting well-being right now, I think there's four broad domains we could talk about, with the caveat that these are useful tips right now, but these are, I also think, strategies we want to carry with us and hopefully have endure far beyond the reach of the pandemic. I think the first tip is a practical one, and that is to sort of know your institution. And what I mean by that is to become knowledgeable about what your institution can offer. So my colleagues and I from philosophy and neuroscience and the arts, we've been sort of talking to one another about what are some of the tools and tips for our staff and academics right now. And I think one of the big ones is just practical. So what can your institution offer you? Some institutions are offering faculty increased tenure clock time, additional funds to support childcare responsibilities for those of us who may be also homeschooling while trying to also, complete our own job responsibilities. So having a sense of sort of what are the resources available practically from your institution, I think, is important. And if you're not sure what those are, to reach out to HR or senior colleagues who may be able to guide you. That's just one piece, to get a sense of what resources are there, and then also have a sense of what you need to ask for that may not be clear. The other three approaches are really more about supporting your own kind of psychological well-being in the face of stress and in the face of both the resources your institution may offer and the limitations of what it's not offering, which I know is a frustration for many staff and faculty. I think the first one that I would really emphasize is looking to the science about what supports our well-being during this time. Certainly, we know that mental health resources in terms of psychotherapy are more flexible than ever, with telehealth and sort of abilities to talk to a mental health professional from your own home at your convenience. But not everyone can see a psychologist or a social worker right now. So I think it's also important to think about what are strategies that you can do, that the science of mental health says and supports its benefits on well-being, as well as alleviating common symptoms of anxiety, depression, and the like. And I thought I'd share a few of those. And this really comes from the intersection of the science of happiness, but also the science of mental health. The first, I think, that's really important is to, when it comes to emotions, really foster an attitude of normalizing and accepting, in particular, negative emotions. And that may sound a bit of a funny thing to say, but what we know is that right now, in the world we're in, with social isolation, stressors, fear of uncertainty, negative emotions are actually quite common. And in many ways, you might argue they're a normal response to a very stressful world. So rather than criticizing yourself or blaming or wishing you felt more joy or excitement in this moment, to also accept and understand that negative emotions are okay too. And in fact, they are signaling a very adaptive response to a very unusual world. So we know, for example, that when we accept our negative emotions rather than criticize, rather than suppress them and push them away, we actually fare better in the long run. So accepting negative emotions is important. And the sort of complement to that is, while we're accepting and normalizing that we may sometimes feel frustrated, we may feel anxious, sometimes we may be even sad, we can also find ways to cultivate appropriate positive emotions that connect us with others. So we know that the emotions of gratitude, the emotions of compassion, these are emotions that make us sort of feel connected to those who have done things for us before, Or in the case of compassion, connect us to people out there we're close to and we want to help and support. These are emotions that we should think about ways we can cultivate in our own life. With respect to gratitude, there are ways we can do just simple daily gratitude exercises, whether it's a journal you have at home, whether it's sending a small note to a friend or a colleague, letting them know what you appreciate about them, whether it's expressing it to your partner or friends in your house, cultivating what we call pro-social emotions that connect us and bind us to others right now is really what we need more than ever. And then I think finally is really paying attention to our body's natural needs. It may sound trivial to say that you need to be moving your body as much as you can while we're sitting at computers all day, or that you need to sleep. But what we see from the psychological literature is that being sure to move our bodies, we know that there's a behavioral activation is a common treatment for depression that suggests that one of the things that may stave off depression is making sure you keep your body moving and engaged, whether that's taking a walk around your neighborhood. It doesn't need to be anything extreme, or doing maybe some sort of exercises at home. Keeping your body moving is important. Sleep, we know as well, when we suffer from our sleep, it's very hard to manage our emotions. We're sort of a little bit more vulnerable in those moments. So as much as we can prioritize sleep as well, I always emphasize that often needs to come first rather than a priority that comes last at the end of a busy day.
Yeah, I think we can all agree on that one, more sleep. All of that stuff sounds like fantastically good advice. And obviously the exercise in particular is something people can literally sort of, you know, put into practice in quite a simple way. And indeed, actually, the gratitude journal, which funnily enough, I started a gratitude journal at the start of 2020, not knowing what was about to unfold, but it has been a very useful tool. So I can recommend that on a personal level. You talked about kind of compassion, the need for, you know, compassionate emotions, or sort of trying to focus attention towards that. I mean, do you think there is a kind of place for, I guess, like a more compassionate approach to leadership from sort of the university leadership, and indeed, I guess, you know, individual faculty as teachers of their students, you know, demonstrating that compassion and just being more understanding of what's going on? And I guess, how could that sort of work in practice? What can people in positions of leadership do to demonstrate more compassion that might sort of filter down and help others?
Absolutely. I've written about this before, this sort of notion that academia needs somewhat of a reality check when it comes to compassion these days. We cannot continue to operate with the same status quo that we've had before this pandemic. I think in terms of things that institutions can do concretely, I think the first thing that institutions can do, both for faculty and what faculty can do for their students, is to first simply state that everything is not normal. I think verbally stating that goes a long way to sort of acknowledge that you know that your faculty, your staff, and your students are in a very abnormal period, right? And that we shouldn't be expected to simply proceed as normal and do our best in these challenging circumstances, that standards will need to change. So stating that things are not normal is a very simple gesture that can go a long way. Second, however, I think is creating incredible amounts of flexibility. I think extending deadlines, giving people the benefit of the doubt, and really being generous in the way we're assessing and evaluating our faculty who may be pre-tenure, as well as our students who are, you know, completing exams, maybe sitting in their car trying to find wireless internet, you know, outside in a parking lot, like just being as generous as we can in these times. I think third, that I'm a huge advocate for, especially for staff and instructors who may also be parents. Myself, I have two small children, and I think that one thing that institutions need to be doing more of is providing accommodations for young faculty and staff. This particularly hits women the hardest. We've seen data that right now women's careers are suffering disproportionately compared to men's that are connected to child rearing responsibilities. And academia needs to give more support and more resources. whether it's, you know, simply giving women extra time to, you know, complete assignments pre-tenure, whether it's being more flexible with meetings for parents who may also be juggling homeschooling, and whether it's really finding also financial resources to help support faculty, staff, and students who may be parents, I think we can and should be doing a better job of this.
Yeah. And then on a more personal level, I suppose, obviously, you've given a fantastic overview of kind of what individuals can do to sort of protect their well-being. But is there, do you have any kind of personal, I suppose, coping mechanisms or strategies that have worked for you that you'd recommend to others?
Yeah, a strategy that I found very helpful, that's also grounded in my training in cognitive behavioral therapy as a clinical scientist, is a way of sort of thinking about timeframes. We often talk a lot about focusing on the present moment, right? When we're thinking about mindfulness or accepting the present moment. But I think there's also an argument to be made that sometimes, especially in these times, we may become overwhelmed by the present moment, rightly so. And that I find thinking about the present moment as temporary has been very helpful, that this is a challenging moment now, but it will end. And thinking to the future horizon, and knowing that, you know, no matter how overwhelming it may be now, the now will not last forever. So I'm often thinking about the future and when things will be a little bit lighter, in the summer, when vaccines are disseminated more widely, when our, you know, research laboratories open again, when schools open again for our children. So remembering that it's temporary and really taking a long-term time perspective, rather than maybe perhaps becoming too consumed by the present moment in these times.
Yeah, and I suppose that might help, you know, your point of this is not normal. If people kind of don't necessarily get too caught up in the present, one of the comments we've had from kind of other academics talking around this topic is that, you know, academics as a general profession are sort of high achievers, overachievers even, and maybe don't set such high expectations for yourself to be turning out endless research papers or whatever it might be at a time when you've also got your kids at home homeschooling, or, you know, whatever you're facing on a kind of personal level. I mean, on that, do you have any kind of, just on a sort of very fundamental level, any kind of, you know, time management sort of hacks, if you like, or efficiency hacks that you've used at all? Or has it purely been a case of just trying to sort of get through it as well as you can?
Certainly I think there's an element of survival, and like you're saying, really not expecting the same that you expected in the past, because that would be, we could argue, not normal or unhealthy to keep pushing along and achieving at the rate we did before this pandemic. And in many ways that leaves faculty and staff, as well as students, at risk for burnout. That being said, I think what I've tried to do with a limited time window is really take a moment to write down my priorities. Like, what are the pieces of my job that mean the most to me? And with the limited time windows we may sometimes have, when I first, you know, open up my to-do list, I go to those first. It does mean that other balls will be dropped because we cannot juggle them all. It will mean that we'll have to tell colleagues that, you know, our response to that project is going to be delayed. But I think when I've made a list of what are the top one or two things that I really want to make sure to take care of during this pandemic, that those always come first. For me, that's been making sure that I can be responsive to my students and trainees in my lab. And I think second, that I'm doing projects that are meaningful right now. So projects involving a call to action among mental health scientists during COVID, a project I hadn't even thought of doing before, but I put it at the forefront because I felt like if we want to take care of our students and we want to try our best during this time to do things that feel meaningful, that can be a bit of a ballast during these challenging times. So don't expect to do it all, but think about what are the one or two things that would mean the most to you right now with the time you have.
Yeah, good advice for everyone, I think that. So I guess we better sort of wrap things up. Just to finish, I think we can kind of all agree that actually, even after the pandemic has hopefully ended, it's clear that online and blended learning will, you know, I think be here to stay in some capacity for most universities now. You know, I think the use of sort of education technologies is only going to grow even when you know, we can go back to delivering much more in-person teaching. So on that basis, I guess as just the last takeaway, what would you say is sort of the most important thing really to make sure that online and blended teaching is made sustainable for staff in the longer term?
I think one of the things that's been a real eye-opener with, as you're saying, the online learning is the flexibility, both geographically, but also time-wise that it's given us, right? It's opened doors to collaborating across the world in ways that may not have been there before. It's also allowed us to be flexible to our students by having lectures that are recorded or allow them to be present in class even if they can't physically make it in. Or are feeling ill. So I think those two components I would hope are here to stay, that we can keep the technology there to become more flexible than we've been in the past for students, and that we can also use it as a way to really bridge geographical divides, to think about innovative ways to be teachers and also researchers in academia.
Yeah. Brilliant. Well, look, thanks so much for talking to us about these pressing issues. There's loads of fantastic advice there. So hopefully anyone listening who is really, you know, struggling with kind of overwork, stress, anxiety, and the many other issues that people are grappling with at the moment will have some kind of solid things to take away from that. So yeah, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I really like June's point there, actually, the message that this is not normal. I think, you know, we're all kind of aware of that. And yet a lot of people clearly in academia, you know, where most people are probably very high achievers or even overachievers, will still be putting huge pressure on themselves to be kind of working and producing at the same rate. And just remembering that we are in extraordinary times seems like a really good message to sort of keep at the forefront of one's consciousness.
I completely agree with that, Miranda, bearing in mind that these are extraordinary times and people are under a lot of stress, to say the least. But I also am getting messages that people are also learning and taking this as an opportunity to check in and see what really wasn't working from the old ways of doing things. And quite a few of the interviews that we've been having with university leaders are saying that actually a lot of the crisis response that they have put in place is something that they will continue doing once we are finally out of the pandemic and out of lockdown and campus life does go back to some sort of quote normality, like you said, Miranda. So there is a bit of optimism there if it is any sort of comfort and something to hold on to, I guess. And also, of course, the resources that we've got on THE campus, these are all in front of the paywall. You can go and check them out and hopefully they are helpful to you in your professional life. But especially this resiliency package is helpful in making sure that you're taking care of yourself.
Well, yeah, and that's what THE campus is really all about. It's a place to learn about online teaching, to share your own expertise, and for academics around the world to connect with their peers. So, you know, do check it out. It's at timeshighereducation.com/campus.
Great. Thanks, Miranda. Thanks for joining me on this podcast. It's nice to see you here instead of on our morning Zoom calls.
Yeah, great to see you too.
And of course, if you have anything that you would like us to cover on the podcast or indeed on THE campus, please get in touch with us. The email is thacampus@timeshighereducation.com. Thank you again, and we'll see you soon.
Bye.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.